You're with RN Breakfast, on air and online.
Good morning, this is AM, and we're broadcasting this morning from a riverboat on the lower reaches of the Murray River. Last federal election, water was a big issue here, but at an AM forum overnight, locals said they were exhausted by the water debate and there were other things that had them hot under the collar. We'll be back to talk about those issues and more from last night's forum a little later. But first this morning, the job of the UN inspectors working in eastern Damascus is fraught with difficulty and increasing tension. They've donned gas masks to collect samples from one of the sites allegedly attacked with chemical weapons last week. While the West debates whether to attack the Syrian government, the region is wondering how far the US will go. Middle East correspondent Matt Brown reports from Beirut.
The prospect of a Western attack on Syria is probably no more hotly debated than amongst Syrians themselves. Thousands a day are streaming across the border into Lebanon, which already hosts more than 700,000 refugees. Those who oppose the government of Bashar al-Assad still fear it, demanding anonymity while they urge the West to take meaningful action to bring him down. A father of three, who gave his name as Issam, wants the West to go all the way.
At this moment, most of people in Syria, they hope American and NATO hit or attack the Syrian government, and we hope soon they will be killed, this President Bashar al-Assad.
But other Syrians are headed in the opposite direction. Abdelmouin Hassan, a resident of Aleppo, is going home to defy the threat of an attack. I'll serve my country in any way I can, he says. If I have to be a soldier, or if I just use my words, I want to go and serve my country. As far as Mr. Hassan's concerned, it's the United States that will look weak when the dust settles. We've been taking hits for 2.5 years, he says, and another strike from the Americans won't finish us. That gets to the root of one of the biggest questions about this threatened attack. What will happen the day after it's over? Istanbul-based opposition spokesman Khaled Saleh knows those proposing the strike profess limited aims, but he still clearly hopes for more.
It is not going to be about bringing change to the regime. It is going to be about stopping the use of chemical weapons again, and that's something that we understand. We believe it's a step in the right direction.
Many Syrian rebels already resent the lack of engagement by the US, which they see as a global superpower missing in action, while jihadists grow in strength. And if Bashar al-Assad's army is left in a position to continue grand-scale killing with conventional weapons, how will the US be perceived in Syria and beyond? The entire region's wondering how the US will be able to balance a punitive strike aimed at deterring the use of chemical weapons with much more crippling action, when it's not sure who would come out on top. This is Matt Brown in Beirut for AM.
Despite reports that a fifth US warship has moved into the eastern Mediterranean, the possibility of an imminent strike on Syria appears to have diminished. US President Barack Obama is still consulting with members of Congress, as well as his allies, over the evidence and how to proceed. And British Prime Minister David Cameron has told his parliament the UK will take no action until UN inspectors report back and there's a vote by MPs. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
In Washington, the debate over the intelligence of the Assad regime's complicity and the impetus for military strikes continues. A number of congressmen and women are being briefed by the White House today, but the chairman of the House Committee on Intelligence, Republican Mike Rogers, says those briefings do not include classified information and are not being provided to enough people.
I think they're trying to do it on the cheap here. I wouldn't do that if I were them. That's been my recommendation to them, is not to do that. And we have to have that more robust discussion to get, again, not only members of Congress and the representatives of the country involved, but also to get buy-in by the American people. This is a serious step in a very complicated problem set in Syria.
The White House says there will be further briefings of Congress, and in a sign he's trying to increase international support for an attack, the White House has confirmed President Obama spoke to Germany's Angela Merkel overnight. But when pushed on the question of whether the president could act unilaterally, White House spokesman Josh Earnest gave this response.
We're invested in the UN process. At the same time, we're currently seeing that process circumvented by an intransigent Russia that is refusing to allow the UN to hold Syria accountable. So what the president will do is he will take, he will make a decision about an appropriate response based on the national security interests of the United States of America.
For some American politicians, the indecision and inaction is damaging U.S. credibility. Representative Mike Rogers says the issue for the U.S. is now bigger than Syria alone.
It was a U.S. credibility that we've laid on the line, some 60 years of very strong carry a big stick and speak softly foreign policy debate that we've had. Well, all of that 60 years of credibility is on the line. Something has to happen.
In the U.K., the British Prime Minister is also under pressure. David Cameron has told Parliament that a military attack on Syria now is a judgment call because there cannot be 100% proof of the Assad regime's guilt. He says the 2003 war in Iraq had well and truly poisoned the well of public opinion and weapons of mass destruction.
No action can be taken until we have heard from the UN weapons inspectors, until there's been further action at the United Nations and another vote in this House. Those are the conditions that we, the British government, the British Parliament are setting.
There are reports British MPs have been warned Parliament could be recalled again as soon as this weekend to vote on military action. This is Michael Vincent for AM.
In revelations that have shocked fans here and overseas, popular Australian entertainer Rolf Harris has been charged with 13 child sex offences. 9 relate to 2 teenage girls in offences alleged to have taken place in the 1980s. 4 charges of making indecent images of a child relate to events alleged to have happened last year. Europe correspondent Mary Geeran reports from London.
There was little sign of movement at the 83-year-old's house in Berkshire outside London, and neighbours wanted little to do with the media posse that's been dropping in and out of the area for months, trying to track down the veteran entertainer. There's been no response either from Mr. Harris's legal or show business representatives to the revelation that he could soon face trial. 9 months after being first interviewed by police, Rolf Harris walked into a police station to be charged with 13 offences. He faces 6 counts of indecent assault between 1980 and 81, relating to a girl aged between 15 and 16, and 3 counts involving a 14-year-old girl in 1986. Mr. Harris also faces 4 charges of making indecent images of a child between March and July last year. If he's found guilty of the indecent assault charges of the early 80s and the indecent images charges, Mr. Harris faces a statutory maximum sentence of 5 years jail for each count. He faces a maximum 10-year sentence for each of the 1986 indecent assault charges. Rolf Harris is the highest profile celebrity to be charged after investigations from Operation Yew Tree. That was set up in the wake of child sexual abuse allegations against the late BBC entertainer Jimmy Savile. But the investigations regarding Rolf Harris are unrelated to Savile's activities. Of the 14 people arrested under Operation Yew Tree, Mr. Harris is the 4th to be charged. Most of the allegations that were made in the wake of the Savile scandal are historical, sometimes decades old, and many relate to celebrities. Criminal solicitor Julian Young says fame is a complication in court.
Fame is possibly a problem from both the defence point of view and the prosecutor's point of view. The prosecutor's point of view, or the police point of view, because of course people see this, it's plastered in the newspapers, and may wish wrongly to join in a bandwagon. For the defence point of view, of course, fame is, what was happening in the BBC or ITV or whichever company it was who was making the programmes, what was the sexual morality of the day. It is a problem from both points of view.
Rolf Harris has made 2 appearances on stage in the past few months since his name was publicly linked to the investigations, and each time he's briefly thanked fans for their support. He'll face court in late September when police say a trial date could be set. This is Mary Geeran in London for AM.
And you are listening to AM around Australia, where it's approaching 20 minutes past 7. The predictable election row over policy costings has taken an unusual turn with an intervention by the Federal Treasury and Finance Departments to correct the record. The coalition says it's an extraordinary move and a direct attack on the credibility of the Prime Minister. Kevin Rudd and senior ministers used Treasury and finance documents yesterday to claim the coalition had a $10 billion black hole in its savings measures. But the government says the coalition could clear up the dispute by immediately releasing the full details of its policies and their cost. The government says this morning it's standing by its claims. The Treasurer, Chris Bowen, has spoken with Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane.
Chris Bowen, has the government been caught politicising the public service by deliberately deciding to release their advice to you to back up the government's claim of a black hole?
Not at all, and we stand by every single word that we said yesterday. Sabra, the opposition released a table of costings that they claimed represent the impact on the budget of savings so far. We pointed out yesterday that that is just plain wrong. And we released advice to the government from the Treasury and the Department of Finance that we made clear yesterday was provided to us before the caretaker period, and we made clear was dependent on the assumptions that went into the costings. We made that clear in our press conference, and that's very similar to what the Departments of Treasury and Finance said later in their statement.
And as they say, that was an extraordinary statement. They advised, this is the Treasury Secretary Martin Parkinson and Finance Department Secretary David Tune, that neither of them have examined the opposition's policies, and any modelling used for costing government policies before the election couldn't really be credibly applied to the opposition here. That's a damning indictment of you, is it not?
No, I don't accept that analysis, Sabra. And let's go through this. For example, we released yesterday Treasury advice that abolishing the low income superannuation contribution, which is opposition policy, would save $1.7 billion. The opposition has claimed $3.7 billion. Now, that's the opposition's policy, to abolish that contribution.
And the Department of Finance and Treasury have said that different assumptions would generate different financial outcomes.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Absolutely. I said that yesterday. The government has said that. For example, an assumption about when that policy starts. Now, if the opposition is making that policy retrospective to 2012, then it would save $3.7 billion. That's an important assumption.
Labor issued a press release of its own in April this year, saying that measure was costed at $4 billion.
Well, that's the case if it's a retrospective. And if it applied, that was the costing into 2012. Then we got an updated costing, which we released yesterday. That's the right thing to do.
Labor MP Andrew Lee says he asked the Parliamentary Budget Office to cost the public service cuts. The Parliamentary Budget Officer, Phil Bowen, says yesterday that it was inappropriate to claim that it's costed any policy other than those submitted by a party itself. In bureaucratic speak, it's a pretty strong rejection of that statement, isn't it?
No, again, Sabra, it's opposition policy to sack 12,000 public servants. Mr Lee asked for that to be costed. Now, again, there's assumptions that are important here. For example, is it natural attrition or is it forced redundancies? Now, the opposition has said elsewhere that it's natural attrition. Is that what the Parliamentary Budget Office costed? Well, we don't know.
If you want the opposition to release its full documents, will you release all the Treasury working papers on your own policies?
We've released what we have in our position, Sabra. We've released.
If the opposition releases its Parliamentary Budget Office documents and it shows that the $10 billion figure is wrong, will you apologise for misleading voters?
Well, Sabra, we won't apologise for being clear and transparent with the Australian people and for releasing the information at our disposal. We have Treasury and Finance advice and Parliamentary Budget Office advice on what these policies would cost.
What are voters to make of the Prime Minister's comments this week about foreign investment? Previously, he said he's an economic conservative. Now he says he's an economic nationalist. Last year, he said the foreign investment balance was about right. Now he's saying he's anxious about it. He's sounding a little like an economic populist, isn't he?
No, I think what he's making the point that foreign investment is a good thing for Australia. We welcome it. But it's important there be transparency and rigour on a case-by-case basis, and that there be public confidence in foreign investment. It's one of the reasons why we've announced the register of foreign land ownership, to instill that public confidence in what is a controversial area. There's low levels of foreign ownership of agricultural land. That might not necessarily be the public perception. If you can introduce more transparency to the process, that's a good thing.
Elders Managing Director Malcolm Jackman's told the Financial Review that the Prime Minister's comments are a cruel joke. And the National Farmers Federation says it's been surprised by his comments, as it hasn't been Labor policy for the last 2 years.
Well, again, the Agriculture Minister released a policy earlier this week which went to the land register, and we are in favour of foreign investment where it's in the national interest. That's always been our position, and we assess these things on a case-by-case basis.
Minister, polling out this morning shows that you are in danger of losing your seat. Bookies have already started paying out on a coalition win. How can Labor turn this around in a week?
Well, Sabra, it's often, as the Prime Minister said, the favourite doesn't always win the Melbourne Cup, and we'll be campaigning very soon and strongly right up to Saturday.
The Federal Treasurer, Chris Bowen, speaking there with Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane. Yes, the early morning sounds on the Murray River at Manham, the home of the riverboats, and as the punt makes its way across the river and the waterfowl come out on the river. We're on board the 30-metre steel motor vessel Proud Mary. In its heyday, the Murray had 250 registered paddle steamers and 500 registered barges working the water from here at Manham right up to the upper reaches of the Darling, the Murrumbidgee and the Lachlan. It's claimed to have been busier than the Mississippi. That was then. Nowadays, business depends on the health of the river. I caught up with Proud Mary skipper Dave Farron. The river today, albeit it's a bit windblown, but it's very full. It looks very healthy. Is everyone happy with the way the river is managed?
Well, I better not get into that, the way it's managed, because of things. But really, at the moment, looking at the river, and I've been on the boat now 25 years, this is the best the river's looked over 15 years.
And why is that?
Because it's had all of these storm waters, the rains, the flushings, the runoffs, and it's, if you look at the river as the kidneys to any land area, it takes all of the contaminants from the land, flushes all through, down into the ocean treats it, gives it back to us as fresh water.
Do you think the rest of Australia actually realises how important this area is?
Only those that directly work within the river system realise the significance and the importance, and that's not even at this stage touching the major importance of the ecology of the river.
If you had a message to the next federal government, whatever that government may be, what would be that message?
Put a one-body government body in charge of the whole system instead of four states that will then take into consideration all aspects of domestic usage, irrigation, farming, production, recreation, the whole thing, one governing body.
Proud Mary skipper Dave Farron. Last night, AM held a forum up the road at Murray Bridge, the fourth largest centre in South Australia. The Murray River dominates these parts. It's the lifeblood for tourism, agriculture and ecosystems. When it comes to discussing water policy, though, the locals told me they're pretty well over it. Other issues that did come to the fore were the level of bureaucracy that business and farmers have to deal with, the apathy of fellow voters as well, of jobs. Overall, many people felt that being in a safe seat did not give them much clout in Canberra.
Neville Mueller from Murray Bridge. When you see where all the handouts are from the politicians, I read in the paper every week, the safe electorate like this actually gets nothing, and all the swinging ones are the ones where all the money's been thrown at, and this is where, because we've got a safe electorate in state and federal, that we're probably disadvantaged that way.
Beyond Gawler or Mount Lofty, we don't exist as far as a lot of politicians are concerned, and that's a strong feeling around the country. And
is anyone else in the same boat?
You know, we've been here since the early 70s, and we've never seen a politician. We live 15 mile out, and we've never seen a politician in 40 years.
Tom Hegg from Murray Bridge. I agree entirely with some of the comments that have been made earlier this evening. I think one of the things that friends and sometimes myself get a little bit fed up with is basically that what we seem in this safe seat anyway that I've lived in for 22 years, what we seem to read about is either cutbacks in community health services, cutbacks to the technical and further education system, where fellow citizens as farmers still doing it tough through policies that are affecting them through imports and etc., etc. The list goes on, Tony, and And one of the things I think that disillusions people and they disengages, they simply do not know who to blame or to hold to account for these things.
Some of the voters at last night's forum. To finance now, and the Dow Jones has closed up 16 points, the NASDAQ up 27 points in London. The FTSE finished the day up 53. The dollar is buying 89.2 US cents. I'm Tony Eastland. We've been broadcasting from the Murray River this morning, and that's AM for today.